Oh, you want me first?
So well.
Hi, my name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic. And I'll let you introduce yourself.
When
you're ready. We have alcoholics. Okay, we're on the doctor's opinion. I think that's where we're at. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. Do you have anything to say about that?
No. I think it's good we have a physician watching over you.
Well, most physicians I know think that we suffer from Valium deficiency or something like that.
What I find very interesting is this book was written in 1939. For all of those meetings where they announce we want to watch what you say, specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction. I didn't write that.
To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of the type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have had a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D. Don't you like that?
It was pretty phenomenal when you think about it. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My name's Paul E. And if you're new, which there seems to be a bunch of you, man, welcome. You know, if you're just coming back, you're off the hook. The war is over. Sit back. Let us love you back to life. Because that's what they've done for me and for countless others. I get amazed every time I read, well, any part of this book. But here, if you think about this, this is 1939. There were 100 people. I mean, in this whole deal. Not like there's 100 people in this meeting. There were 100 people in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they had the foresight, because it wasn't only Bill Wilson, it was God that was speaking through Bill, and certainly in my opinion, they had the foresight to say, wow, this thing's going to get real big. And look what's happened. You know, a few years ago, they were speaking about making Bill Wilson the man of the year because of how many millions of lives he has touched through these 12 suggested steps of recovery. It's not that AA is the only answer. Probably other answers that work. I tried a bunch. They didn't work for me. AA was the only one that worked for me. That total surrender, the total desperation. You know, my sponsor always said the desperate becomes sweetly reasonable. And if you're here tonight and you're desperate, no matter what, and you just say, you know, I can't do that anymore, whatever that is. And you come in here and you're in a safe place. This is a safe place, Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there's one thing, I just read it today, and it's funny that we're on the doctor's opinion. Well, I actually knew that. That's why I wrote it down. Russell didn't know where we were at, but I knew we were at. He's got other things on his mind, you know.
Yeah, like counseling you on your legal problems. You're trying to get me to give you a legal opinion before we start the meeting.
He's got me out of prison.
I had this incredible spiritual, profound thing that I was going to say, and I forgot all about it.
Thank God.
But that's you got yourself into New York.
Right.
But it's not
just
bad.
A little bit of sexual harassment. It wasn't my fault.
Whatever. Did you?
No,
did you say hi to Peter M, who's in the audience?
Oh yeah, I saw him there. Actually, ladies and gentlemen, can we have a real hand for Peter M there in the corner? Rarely have we seen Peter come to hear us.
He said, well,
he's coming here just to correct.
He heard there was a train wreck. He heard there was a train wreck going on, and he wanted to see if.
So anyway, Peter, welcome. We'll give you some material. Anyway, here we go. This was in today's New York Post. I found it so hysterical that I had to write it down. I just flew down today. Okay, so you'll pass an extra basket to pay for my flight. But. On the New York Post that I read on the page, they were talking about this guy, Behan or Bohan, who just killed his girlfriend or his wife somewhere. I don't even know if it was up there or wherever. But the attorney, probably one of Russell's friends, this was his defense for this guy. I found it amazing. I mean, the guy's going to go to prison for life, but this was his defense. He claimed, Your Honor, members of the jury, my client killed this woman because he has what's known as intermittent explosive disorder. Swear to God. So if you think you've got issues, not only does the, I mean, this was the best he could do for $2 million that the guy paid him?
Listen.
Intermittent explosive disorder, so I whacked her? Come on.
Listen, are you looking at this crowd? Why would you give them ideas like that? I'm looking at these guys.
This is a desperado.
I think they're all packing.
Only the front row here.
Well, I actually have something to
please
opine.
Go, opine away.
So, the interesting thing, the one part that grabs me on this and always has, I use it sometimes, I think it's amazing, is this last line. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. And, I try to think about why do I love that line that some physician says you can rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. You know, prior to the big book being written, I think a few years prior to the big book being published, there was a book written by Dr. Carl Menninger called Man Against Himself, and there's a chapter in that book about alcoholism. And in that chapter, he says, the first line, he says, men, alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. You know, anybody who either reads the paper or watches what's going on here or watches what's happening with different people knows that one of the hallmarks of this disease is no matter how rich or poor or whatever you are in life, if you're an alcoholic and it's untreated and it's a spiritual disease, that somehow, some way, you're going to figure out a way of screwing up your life and destroying yourself and other people. And, I've sort of thought about this and what the deal is, living with my own self. And this is my own experience. And one of the conclusions I've come to is that somehow, some way, for whatever reason, that, and I'll use the word alcoholics. I'm not talking about you guys because I can tell you're a cut above. But I mean, alcoholics like me, somehow, some way, can't, you know, hate themselves. There's some sort of, I mean, I know it's kind of weird. You know, in one sense, you know, you think you're the greatest, you're special, you know, you're entitled. But there's some sort of underlying thing where you wish you were dead. You just hate yourself. You don't think you deserve. You don't think you deserve to live. You know. You feel unjustified or not. You know. And that must be probably something to do with the reason why. Well, one of the things I've learned as an alcoholic, one of the ideas we have, you know, that's kind of a hallmark of, I guess, an alcoholic, maybe other people, is we tend to think that we're unique, that nobody could possibly understand us because nobody knows how we think and we're so different. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, by speaking and by listening to other people speaking, is that we're twins. Like, we're just exactly alike, you know. I mean, the differences are, like, imperceptible. As a matter of fact, the more transparent I get and the more honest I am, the more I know myself and the more I can talk about myself honestly, the more people come up to me and say, you're talking about me. You know, when men and women come up to me and say, you're talking about me, and I'm not talking about them, I'm talking about me, the more it tells me that we're alike. And so if I'm in the shower and all of a sudden a thought comes up and all of a sudden I hear the voice, you know, I wish you were dead, you know, you don't deserve to live. You're an idiot. You're stupid. If I find myself from time to time condemning myself, saying hateful things, you know, that's my reputation with me about me. When I had that stuff going on, and that's not coming down from like Venus or from Mars, that's coming down from somewhere deep inside of me. And I'll tell you what, you know, it's like Muzak. It comes out of nowhere, and then it fades away, and it comes back. And I tend to think that even if I'm not saying that to myself, it's coming from someplace deep inside of me that it's always sort of running. It probably has to do with some of the choices I make. It has to do with whether or not I raise my hand or I don't raise my hand. Does anybody know the answer? I may know the answer, but what if I'm wrong? It has to do with second-guessing yourself. It has to do with worrying about what other people think about you. It has to do with feeling like you don't belong or you're not as good. It has to do with a whole lot of crap. You understand what I'm saying? And I think, and so I think to a certain extent, especially when you come in here after drinking and drugging and all that sort of stuff, I mean, I think the self-hatred rises to such a place that it's devastating. And I think the reason I like this line, where a doc says you can rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves is the chance that I could have integrity. Because when you're a lying piece of shit, excuse my language, but you know, you guys are grown up. When you leave a wife and a 5-year-old child and you walk away because you'd rather leave them because you want to get laid and drink, and you're a lawyer and you're in your 30s and all you do is care about yourself, you can tell yourself a whole lot of lies, but deep down inside you know you're a piece of crap and you know you're a bum. And you know there's no way you'll ever get better, and there's no way you can ever be forgiven, and there's no way you deserve to live on the planet Earth. So to even get a glimpse of the possibility that you can be redeemed, you can find some salvation, that somehow, some way, somebody's saying that these are men who have integrity, you can believe what they say about themselves, when every word out of my mouth is a lie, is like a big deal for somebody like me. I mean, what do you think? Wouldn't that be a bad thing to sort of, instead of feeling like you're a piece of crap, to think that you're a man of integrity or a woman of integrity and that you deserve to live and deserve to be here and you're justified? So, you know, that's why I sort of like that line. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we probably
how could it not make sense?
I don't know. I'm just
spent 8 minutes talking about one line.
I'm trying to.
You know what it is? The problem is you think you're an attorney getting paid by the hour up here. We only have an hour. That's the problem. These guys don't need billable hours. Okay?
I got it. Well, if it was billable hours, I would call that at least a half an hour.
Exactly. We know that. Anyway, just out of curiosity, I was thinking about looking at this group of desperados. How many people have ever been in jail that are here? That's a shocker.
Oh, don't be shy, the entire group.
No, the other ones are in denial. They weren't in jail.
Just ask how many people haven't been to jail.
Right. And secondly, and just out of curiosity, I was thinking about this today on the plane. I wonder what I'm on. How many people have been in an institution? Just for the record, for those that didn't raise your hand, if you're in a treatment center or you've ever been in a treatment center or you've ever been in a place where at 6 or 7 o'clock they say time to get on the band, that's an institution, okay? I just wanted to clarify that. Because I know they tell you, no, this is Betty Ford Center. That's an institution, okay? The reason you're there is because you can't be trusted on your own. You need to be supervised, told when to get up, when to go to sleep, what meetings to go to, how to say thanks, how to say hello, how to make your bed, and all that, because you're mental defectives. And it says that in this book. The greatest thing in this book later on, if you're still here, it says we're mental defectives. So the point is, when I think, oh, by the way, this disease takes us to one of three places. Jails, institutions. What's the last one? There's your choices. You played the first two out. I would certainly try to really focus on how to stay here to not play the other one out. Just my belief system. You know, and the other thing I wanted to say, and then we'll read the next thing, is think about this doctor in 1939, how he went out on the limb after watching for years and years. There was no even semi-remedy for alcoholism. You know, they had a few attempts. They had the Oxford group. They had the Washingtonians. But here he gets this guy, Bill Wilson, and he sees there may be a shot. He writes this first thing that we just read. You can absolutely trust anything they say to you. And then he writes the rest of it that we're going to read right now. To me, this guy, Dr. Silkworth, who ended up being one of the reasons that Alcoholics Anonymous is where it is today. But imagine this guy, he stepped out as a doctor. I mean, like, imagine his parents sent him to medical school, and they're all thrilled that he's got his shingle up there, you know, his degree. And they say, so, Dr. Silkworth, Bill, what are you going to be doing now with your life? He says, I'm going to help alcoholics, and I'm going to write letters about how trustworthy they are. This is something that you could never, ever count on. There was no answer for this terminal disease. So he really stepped out on a limb, and I think about that all the time. God working through him, working through Bill, working through us, said, hey, you know what? This thing can really help save millions of people. I mean, it's incredible. You know, last thing I'll say, I was in New York, I just told you, for a few days, and last night I'm at a meeting in New York City. And, you know, there's a bunch of people with time, and somebody's speaking, and he says, I have 22 years, and blah, blah, blah. So did anybody knew, they say? And this guy raises his hand. He says, yeah, I'm Martin. I have 10 days. Everybody claps. And then he says, yeah, but you know what? I'm not sure. I think I'm really ready, but I'm not sure how I'm going to get 20 years. So I looked at him. I couldn't help myself. I said, Martin, my suggestion, try to get 20 days. You don't get 20 years in a bushel basket. You get 20 years by going to meetings one day at a time for 20 years, having 20 years of experiences, and then and not picking up. And by the grace of God, that's how you get 20 years. So don't look ahead. Whatever you have today, be grateful for today. It's all we have. It's all any of us have. Should I read the next part there, Junior?
Absolutely.
Thank you. See, he went to college, so he likes to read. My college was Creedmoor State Hospital. As a matter of fact, you know, all the college places, they all have their teams and they have their slogans, you know, about, you know, FSU and Penn State, Ohio State. All of my friends have these colleges. And when the NCAA, when the football thing is on, you know, in the bowl games, and everybody's like rooting for their team. My graduating class at Creedmoor, we did not have a team. As a matter of fact, if we had a motto at Creedmoor State Hospital, it would have been first and goal forever. Because there were a bunch of dribblers in Creedmoor State. Anyway, here we go. The physician, that's Dr. Silkworth, who at our request gave us this letter, has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking. Oh, here, listen to the line. I didn't realize it was even this close. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or we were outright mental defectives. I didn't write this. This is Dr. Silkworth in 1939. So when you go home tonight, you look in the mirror and you say, how could he call me a mental defective in full flight of reality? with no concept of what's going on. That's how we end up in these nut houses. The same way, we have no clue as to what's going on. Our mind is abnormal. And these things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us, because as laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may of course mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account.
Well, you know what the only thing I'm going to say about this particular part is, you know, I've been sober for a little over 33 years. And so for that period of time, I've been dealing mostly with the dis-ease, the spiritual dis-ease of alcoholism, which is to a certain extent apart from the symptom of our disease, the drinking part, and is a spiritual malady. And so that's what I've been focused on, and that's what I focus on in my tests. But the fact of the matter is, when I came into alcoholics, I agree with this, I believe with this, I believe it's, to me it's axiomatic. In other words, I don't question it. Because when I can only tell you this, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had gone through college, I fancied myself like a scientist, I was taking mathematics and algebra, I was going for degrees in algebraic topology, I was all into the thinking and the scientific deal, not the God deal at all. So to me, I can only tell you this, the approach in trying to figure out why I drank the way I did, the approach, whether it be right or wrong, and I happen to believe it's right, that there was some sort of biological factor, okay, that, you know, people come in here today, you ever hear people say, why am I an alcoholic, and that never bothered, the why am I an alcoholic never bothered me, because I bought into the deal, which helped me, that I have some sort of allergy, I have some sort of biological or chemical or DNA thing where just somehow alcohol works differently in me, and that's one of the problems I have. And once I accepted that, that helped me to get by a whole bunch of this, why me or whether I can beat it or not. It played into my being able to accept that I'm an alcoholic. Not only admit that I'm an alcoholic, but accept that I'm an alcoholic, so it worked for me. Now, the truth of the matter is, I don't know whether I think about it that much now about the allergy, although I do believe that as an alcoholic, you know, I've mixed thoughts about this. You know, it says our disease centers in our mind, not our body, the way we perceive things, the way we think about things, the way we talk. I mean, I'm like one of these guys, I can shake somebody's hands and they say a few words to me and I say, this guy's either a drink, you know, just by the phrases we use and how we think about ourselves, I'm not so sure that isn't biochemical either. You know, it could be part of it too. But I do know that even in our craziness, when we're sober, and we like to think we're different, a lot of the things we suffer from, a lot of the problems we suffer from, the mental maladies we suffer from, you know, normal people have the same things going on. They just maybe not as much. But in any event, this was very helpful to me to buy into the idea, which I believe is true, that there's some sort of biochemical or allergy or something like that when it comes to alcohol and accept that deal. So that's the only thing I have to say about that.
Okay. It's true. I mean, I was thinking of something else. I only half listened when Russell speaks, and I was looking at Cassie.
You were thinking of a legal problem.
Yeah, no. But then the fact is, I mean, he's obviously right. And we're told from day one it's a threefold disease. It's mental, it's physical, and it's spiritual. And all three of those need to be addressed. And I know my sponsor, God rest his soul, always said that physical good health is the number one enemy of the alcoholic. And let me explain what that means. You guys, especially the new guys, okay? No matter how beat up you were yesterday or the week ago, whenever you came into this deal, no matter how beat up you are, 6 days from today, you're going to be feeling good. No matter how beat up you are, I don't care what you drank, how much you drank, how much you used, how bad things got. A week, week and a half, 2 weeks. Wow. I can't believe I did all that. I am on top of it now. And that's what Ray meant about physical good health being the number one enemy. Because now what happens, I'm back on game. Why would I need to go to these silly places? All right, I'll stop in when I have a chance. I'm not certainly going to make this any important part of my life. And the reality is, and I'm not saying this to scare you, I don't ever try to scare alcoholics. That's the silliest thing in the world. People have been threatening you your whole lives. If you do this, that. If you do that, this. And obviously, how did that work? So threatening an alcoholic is not the answer. All I can do is make a promise. And this is the promise. If you're an alcoholic, I'm going to make that assumption you are, and you're in this deal tonight, and you put any time together, and you don't get into the deal, like he said something I love, which is, well, I don't know if he said it this way, but I bought the whole package of Alcoholics Anonymous. The whole package. The book, the people, the fellowship, the God, the getting to meetings early, the leaving meetings late, the interaction with people. The first thing that caught my attention in my first meeting, someone had a t-shirt on and it said, I can't, we can. 34 years later, I can't do this alone. That's why I was in a meeting almost every night when I was in New York. And if you don't think it was cold, if you weren't watching the weather, I was laying in bed this morning, and I heard Al Roker, or one of whoever that was, he says, well, it's a nippy 18 degrees right now. And I started laughing. My wife says, what are you laughing about? I said, did you hear what this moron just said, 18 degrees? So anyway, that was not in my wheelhouse. So the key is that if you don't jump in, you're not going to get it. I don't know how else to put it. You know, my sponsor used to say, if you want what we have, you do what we do. And if you don't want it, don't worry about it, because you have no chance of getting it. And, you know, that sounds like so cruel and raw. Oh, my God, how could you say that? I say it because it's true, because I'm really tired of burying people. I'm tired of visiting people in prison that had this thing and threw it away. And that's what happens, okay? It's a daily reprieve we get from this deal. I can't do it a week at a time, a month at a time. I can only do it a day at a time, no matter how long any person is sober. One day, that's all we have to do it. Right here, right now, for today. And so please, I mean, come in this deal. We need you. Because if I have to sit and talk to him for much longer, I mean, either one or both of us is going to get loaded. So, you know, we need new people. That's the way this thing works.
Well, one of the things, this thing about the allergy and how we're physically and biologically different than other people out there, I remember a story that comes to me that I haven't told in many years, which is true, is I had a friend when I was about 4 or 5 years sober. His name was Phil, and he was a doctor. And he would tell me this story about how he had a sponsor. His sponsor was a doctor. And how he said to his sponsor one time, you know, he says, you know, I remember a time when I wasn't an alcoholic, you know, because one of the touchstones of being an alcoholic, the symptoms, is this idea of the craving. You crave alcohol and the obsession that you're always thinking about it, and you're craving it and you're thinking it. And he says, well, I remember a time when I would go to the bar. He's telling his sponsor, I would go to the bar and I said, I'm only going to have 3 drinks. And that's all I'm going to have, 3 drinks. And I'd walk in the bar and I'd have 3 drinks. And after the 3 drinks, I would leave. And so he said to his sponsor, he says, I wasn't an alcoholic at that time. And his sponsor says, no, he says, you were a stone alcoholic. He says, what do you mean? He says, and he said, Phil, non-alcoholics don't walk in the bars and say, I'm only going to have 3 drinks. They go in the bars, they drink or they don't drink, they put it, they sip it, they put it down, they pick it up, they leave, they go. They don't think that way, you know? They don't think, I'm only going to have three, I'm only going to have two, this is my third, I got to leave. You were alcoholic then, you know? We don't think that. We think just because we're not crashing the car and we're not DUI, we're not alcoholic. As soon as we say, I'm only going to have one, we got it, you know? We're already obsessing about it, we're already craving it, we're already worried about it, but we're like in denial, you know, the denial deal. So, you know, that's one of the things where I'm obviously absolutely different from the people, other people, that walk in there and I don't even realize I have the disease. I think I don't because I'm not getting into trouble or, you know, I'm not having consequences. You want to move on?
Move on.
The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests, you already read that. Though we work at our solutions on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcohol who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached. He has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. The doctor writes, the subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulty beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in the hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here. With some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through, have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of a profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed of his physical craving for liquor. And this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomena of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Fraudy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. That's a good place to stop.
Absolutely.
Don't you think?
I agree. You know, there's so much in here. I still get amazed. I thank God, you know, that all this time later and having been coming here straight through for all this time, I still live on the word wow when I read this. It's beyond human comprehension. I mean, forgetting about my story, I'm just talking about if you really think about wherever you came from, and the fact that you're sitting here and you're somewhat healthy and you have a chance. Wow, you know, he told this story about Phil when he was 5 years old or something, whatever. I don't remember anything before 10. But when I was about 14 or 15, I was drinking, and these guys in my neighborhood, we all had phony proof. I'm from New York, in case you have a hearing problem. And so we had all had phony identification, and we used to go to this bar out in Glen Cove, Long Island, called the Pied Piper. And what they did was, it was a bar and a club and a dance place, and they dared me, it was three or four of them, that if we went out to the bar, they would buy me as much booze as I could drink, but that they would have to order it, and they would pay for it. Without a moment's hesitation, I said, let's go. We got in the car, four of us, and we drove to the Pied Piper. We sat up there, and they ordered me a shot of scotch, a shot of gin, a shot of... Now, since I'm looking around, and I don't think that anyone here was in the Pied Piper back in 1960-something. Most of you weren't born. So I would like to say that I sat there for hours. They ran out of booze. They said, oh, my God, and they had to send to the neighboring pubs to send more booze in. That's not what happened. Probably after a very short period of time, I passed out. They then picked me up, and they put me in the bushes outside the club. Keep in mind, it's the first time I drank. They went back into dance, probably talking about what a moron I was. Can you believe he did that? Yeah. And they did. So the night's over. They come out, and they come to get me. I'm now covered in my own puke, the first time I drank. They put me in the car. They take me home. They ring my mom's doorbell, may she rest in peace, and they leave me there. My mom says, oh, my God, takes me and puts me into bed. This is the interesting part to me. The next morning, I woke up with a full-blown case of poison ivy, head to toe. The bushes they put me in were poison ivy. Now, 30, 40 years later, however many years later, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They give me this silly book, and it says, it will appear that we have an allergy to alcohol. In the early 60s, Helen Keller could have told I had an allergy to alcohol. That wasn't the end, it was just the beginning. So, you know, I mean, this deal is here, but you need to surrender. And that's one thing that happens once with booze early on, and then the life cycle is about continual surrenders. In all different areas, in all different ways, surrendering your defects, surrendering more to God, surrendering to your sponsor, surrendering to the fact that you really have very little to do with the world, okay? And all you are is like this little cog in the machinery, no matter how big you are, no matter how little you are, that's all you are, you're a pebble on a beach, a grain of sand. But you know what? I want to be the best grain of sand I can be today. And that's what I strive for. You know, I mean, like he said, you know, you can absolutely count on anything I say to you today. It's a pretty cool thing. You know, to know that I can sleep with my door open. Nobody's looking for me. My telephone number is listed. What, are you kidding me? That's not humanly possible. Because none of this is humanly possible, and that's when we get in to the power granted ourselves, which is so necessary to beat this thing. So necessary to beat this thing.
Well, here's where the big book, and I think it's so such a genius the way it does, the way it works, here's where the big book tricks alcoholics into believing in God. You know, alcoholics are sensitive. You know, I told my sponsor, I said, I'm sensitive. He said, because he used to hurt my feelings a lot by saying things like the truth. And I said, I'm sensitive. He said, no, Russ, great artist is sensitive. You're just touchy. You know, the guy who wrote this article that we're talking about, he had read the manuscript. He had read the whole thing. He knew what was in the book. He's seen these guys have come upon something. And one of the things he had read, he has read something called A Chapter to the Agnostic. Now, actually, the only chapter in the whole book that's to the non-believer, the person without faith, is called The Chapter of the Agnostic. And it's written specifically, and you can read it yourself and decide what you want to have it say. I mean, you can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts. What it basically says is this sort of thinking has to be abandoned. Get over it, okay, if you want to live. It says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life would have solved our problem, we'd be sober a long time ago. I mean, we're all brilliant, we're all smart, and we're all drunk. I said, our problem was lack of power. We had to find a power that was greater than ourselves, and that means we wrote a book where we're going to talk about God. And then it says right after that, here the hackles in our hair stand up, because we don't want to hear it. The solution to our problem, we don't want to hear. And one of the geniuses of the big book, you know, later on, we all know later on, they're going to say things like, there is one who has all power, that one is God, may you find him now. See the relationship with him is bright, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You know, it's going to say that you can't manage your life, no human power, only God could and would if you were sought. It's going to say if you sincerely took such a position, all sorts of incredible things are going to happen to you. Being all powerful, he'll give you everything you need if you stay close to him and perform his work well. They're going to talk about God, 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 God. We never apologize for God. It's all going to be about God, a relationship with God, and that's what the whole thing's going to be about. It's going to say nonsense, job or no job, it's just trusting God, and the whole thing's going to be about God. Silkworth had read all that when he's talking about this. There's nothing about God in here, right? He just says this. He says, fraud the emotional appeal, and he's going to do it. He uses words like psychology, so you think maybe it's a psychological book. And then it says, the message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. Well, what do you think he's talking about? He had read the book. He knew what these guys were about to lay on the alcoholic. He knew what they were going to say to the alcoholic. So when he said, this message has to have something that's different, some sort of gravitas, something of depth, something of weight, something that's so much more weightier and greater than the crap that had been thrown at him. You know what I'm talking about? Important stuff like, you're killing your kids. You're hurting your mother. You know, can't you see what you're doing to yourself? You know what that means to an alcoholic? Like, nada. You know, your kids are dying. Your mother's dying. Your father's going to die of a heart attack. Yeah, let me have another drink. You know what I mean? Who gives a shit? You know, that's the bottom line. The message that basically he says we're going to key in on has to have great weight and depth. What do you think it's going to have to do with? Getting in another car? Getting laid? What do you think it's going to have to do with? What do you think he's talking about? He knew what the message of this book was. It's interesting that he doesn't seemingly say anything about God. This is where Alcoholics Anonymous is so great. It pulls the bait and switch. It's sort of, he has this whole sort of like psychological, medical field, and it's a psychological, and you're going to get into this thing all disguising what the bottom line is. You're about to hear something that's going to rock your socks, that's going to make you interested. And the interesting part of this book is when they're going to talk about God. We're going to talk about what he's going to do for your life, the miracles that are going to happen. You know, they say later on in the book, he says, what do they say? They say here and there once in a while, ideas, emotions, and attitudes are suddenly cast one side. They become dominated by holding ideas and emotions. We call these things phenomena, which is a scientific way of saying miracles. We can't explain them. So that's one of the beauties of this book. It sort of comes at the alcoholic who walks, you know, we all walk in here, we say, I don't want any part of religion. I'm spiritual, not religious. I don't want any part of religion. I don't want any part of God. It's sort of somehow, how does it take an alcoholic who doesn't want to hear anything about God, is basically atheistic, only cares about himself, and brings him through this thing where he's 10, 15, 20, 30 years sober, and all he's doing is focusing upon God? You know, how does that happen? It's amazing. Well, it's happening in this book. You know, you don't realize it, but it's happening very slowly in this book. By the time you get to the end of this book, that's all they're talking about. By the time you get to Vision for You, man, that's all they're talking about. They start out with some sort of psychological thing, and he knew what they were about to lay on you. Just remember, as he's talking about this, he had read the book.
I get amazed with your profundity.
So oh, well, thank you.
It's so true. I mean, he's just like must have done some reading this week, or else I'm still jet lagged, but he sounds so good. But you know what it is, really? And what he says, a bait and switch, and I've always said this, it's a scam. Alcoholics Anonymous is a scam. It's the biggest scam in the world, okay? They say, oh, come, let us love you back to life. You don't need to do anything. Go to some meetings. Get a sponsor.
Don't worry about that God thing.
Don't drink. Don't drug. Just keep showing up. Get a commitment. And then your sponsor says, okay, let's get into the steps. And by the way, it's just new, like in the last 15 years, that Jeff's writing assignments, okay? That wasn't the case. But I mean, the fourth step is where you write. All the other steps, you just either are or you aren't. You're either powerless, and you know if you pick up, you're done, or you're not, and you're not, okay? You've unconditionally surrendered, or you haven't. So then you come around. Now, think about this. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. That's the first step of this program. Would everyone agree?
Yeah.
Great. If you're powerless, the next stage or phase or suggestion, you need to find a power. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see where they're going here. So obviously, okay, I'm powerless. And by the way, I'm sitting here, just if you don't think I have any obsessions or mental deep, I'm sitting here looking at this Dunkin' Donuts that Russell brought in here, and I was being so good at not opening it. But I swear to God, I'm going to, because, I mean, really, what are you kidding me? And you know, like, and I've gained a few pounds since I'm sober. Let me explain how much. I was at this meeting, not last night, but Tuesday night in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and there's some guy, and he comes up to me and he says, hi, I'm Maurice. I say, wow, you look, he says, are you Paul? I say, yeah, we know each other from 30 years ago. The guy looks at me and he says, oh my God, what happened to you? I said, what are you kidding me? He said, what, you gained 100 pounds? What, you swallow a person? So that's just part of the deal. But I will be having some of these after me. So the bottom line is, you know, when he was throwing all the God quotes out, we all got it, okay? The bottom line is, when you get to the chapter to the agnostics, which is before how it works, which is before where it says God couldn't, would if he was sought. Chapter to the agnostics is the fourth chapter. And it says throughout there, it's like a very cool thing, but you can't possibly read it and say, wow. It says, God either is or he isn't. He either is or he isn't. God is everything or else he is nothing. Now, I just told you that this whole thing's a scam. Listen to the next line. They don't want to put you in a corner, so they say, what was our choice to be? Real simple. You don't have to believe. There's your choice. He either is or he isn't. He's either everything or he's nothing. What do you want to do about it? And you know, he was talking about a thing about coincidences. Or has anyone ever heard that thing, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous? Anybody ever hear that? Hello? Anybody here? Just checking. No, I mean, really, everybody's sitting there smiling, but like these, like the freaking wax museum. You know? I mean, let me see a little emotion here. Come on. So, anyway, here's a coincidence. It just happened. I live my life on these coincidences because they're, like, amazing, and they happen to me all the time. Don and I, you'll be up here one day, if the warrants are ever removed. Don and I just went for a quick bite across the street. A restaurant neither of us have ever been in, on Federal Highway, a nice Italian restaurant, a little bit north of here. And we went in just for a quick bite. And we pull in there, and we walk up, and there's two girls getting out in front of valet parking, or at valet parking. And they're dressed and with these tight little skirts, and, you know, I mean, fairly hot, I guess, you can say. I mean, anything in a short skirt is hot to me, but this was pretty hot. And we're walking past them. This is exactly, no, I'm not kidding you. We're walking past them into the restaurant, and I say to them, I say, wow, you didn't have to get this dressed up. I'm sorry I didn't. She looks at me. Come listen to me. She looks at me, she says, I can't believe that. You were on our flight coming down here. Now, what is the chances, the possibility, the human probability of me going to a restaurant I've never been to, I just landed 3 hours ago, these two chicks landed 3 hours ago, I don't know who they are, where they are, and they're pulling into this restaurant at the exact minute that we're pulling into this restaurant, I don't know. I just have to believe that it's something that's operating this deal. And the longer you're sober, the more of those things you see. Of course, you're looking for them. You're awake.
What is it? God wanted you to meet these girls? I'm trying to understand.
Let me explain this, Russell. I'm taking the donuts to them after the meeting. That's why I'm going with the donuts. What do you think, I'm a moron? Anyway, I mean, and also, by the way, this is about laughter. You know, my sponsor always told me the war is over. Please, come in, let us hug you, love you, let us help you surrender. Because then, as it said in here early on, the answer, which we all know, is to find that next person in the gutter. That's the answer, because when I have someone in the gutter that I'm sharing with, no matter what's going on in my life, no matter what problems I may or may not have, I'm not thinking about them at that time. When I'm talking to some guy that's facing 18 years in prison and he's going away and he's trying to stay sober, do you think I have any problems? I'm just sharing with him, well, trust the process, you know, but I'm not thinking about me. And so that's the key. It's a, you know, oftentimes people say it's a selfish program. Nonsense. It's a selfless program. The less I think about me, the more I think about you. The more I think about you, the more in touch I am with God. The more in touch I am with God, the better I feel about me. It's like one of these amazing things, you know. The more I give away, the more I get. It's because it's like the same thing. Still instant gratification, which I was always looking for. I just get it different ways now. Now I get it by watching the miracle in you, reinforcing the miracle in me. And I just wish and hope and pray that every one of you, I know that's not possible, but that as many of you as possible, I know that's not possible, but even one of you grabs onto this and says, you know what? I have to have that. And if you have to have it, there's people in this room that will help you get it. And that's the key. That's what we do. That's how we stay here, by helping you get it. So please jump in. The water's fine.
And you know, the big book really describes God. He really does. It lays the picture right out. You know, it says in the 12 and 12, it says in the sixth step, the one that separates from the men from the boys, it says the men, or the ladies, the women, are the ones who try repeatedly all these steps so they can grow in the image and likeness of their Creator. And when it talks about growing in the image and likeness of our Creator, the way they describe that person, what it says about that person is we start losing our interest in our little plans and our designs. And what happens is we lose all interest in our little plans. We start thinking about how can I help other people. We start focusing on other people. So if that's what God is about, if that's where we're going to, then I imagine what they're saying is what God does, what God is about, is just focusing on you. He doesn't think about it. He thinks about you. He's concerned about you. He's concerned with you. Infinitely and unbelievably concerned. I don't know what kind of God of your understanding is, but the God of my understanding is concerned about having a relationship with me. And I have a relationship with him. Which is great because he's even around at 3 o'clock in the morning. When you guys aren't even around. And I can't get to sleep and I'm worried about something. Okay? So, should we go on?
No, we've got the director here.
They have the directors there. Okay. Question.
Right now, the speakers will take the questions. Please remember, it's not a time for sharing. It's a time for you to ask the questions directly about what was presented here tonight. So, the first one up is always the best one. So.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got a question out there. Yes, sir. Is that a sir? I can't tell.
Questionnaire right here.
Yes, sir. Stand, would you stand up, please? Oh, is that Vinny? What is that?
I'm not Vinny.
Yeah, okay.
You said in here that Dr. Cole injured men against themselves.
Yeah.
Talked about that with Dr. Silkworth.
No. He wrote a book called Man Against Himself.
Right. That he wrote the book Man Against Himself. Okay, was he in that whole loop with Jung and
Manager was a well-known psychiatrist, very well-known at the time. I really honestly don't know. I'm sure he was aware of who Dr. Jung was. I'm not sure of what kind of loop he was in as far as Dr. Jung is concerned. I don't know.
The one thing I know is he was around before they had the manager clinic. Anyway, what about you there, the blind girl in the corner? You had your hand up? I forget your name.
Tracy.
Yeah, Tracy, that's it. I'm sorry.
I'm calling you Tracy.
Hey, Tracy.
Hi, everybody. Great to be here. Thank you both for your service. I do not have a question.
Fine, you better ask some questions, Tracy. You're in trouble. How could nobody have a question? Thank you. Okay. Yes, sir.
Try not to call it. Did I hear, your guys' definition of a frothy emotional appeal, subtle surprises? I've heard,
What was the question?
Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. How do you guys interpret that?
You gotta stop right now. What are you kidding? You know what you're doing to your family? What are you insane? You're nuts. You know what you're doing to me? I can't get out of bed thinking about you. I can't sleep because I know you're gonna get cold and you're dead.
How about this? You're killing yourself. Can't you see what you're doing? You never had that happen to you.
Oh, I have.
Oh.
Was that frothy enough or emotional enough?
Hey,
did you ever get either of those things?
Did that work for you? That stopped you?
No, it didn't work for
you. Okay.
That's why we're all
thank
here.
You. You'll be Exhibit
work.
A.
Right. Let's go. We got some more questions. Really. The only question that's a stupid question is the one you don't ask. Because if you're sitting here, and especially if you're in one of those houses for the very, very nervous, where they tell you when to do, what to do, and you don't have a question. Thank you very much. Hey,
she brought the donuts.
She got the... Yeah, no, you know what? Whoever brought them, I'm very upset. I have another resentment. They're not donuts. They're muffins. I don't eat muffins.
Yes.
See, I'm going to bring those to the women? Come on.
Okay.
Oh, okay. This part, for the ultimate understanding, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge.
Yeah. They have too many O's in good.
No, no.
Too many O's in good.
This is one.
You take one O out. He's not talking. He's talking about God. He's talking about God, but it's all code. Well, what do you think he's talking about when he says when he's saying it's outside our ideas of science? It's outside of our synthetic knowledge. It's some sort of it's got to be weight and depth. What can he possibly be talking about when he's read the book and he knows what they're going to talk about? They're going to use God all through the. What could he possibly be talking about? I mean, come on. I mean. Pretty obvious, I think.
Another question. Thank you. In the back, yes.
Wow.
Could you stand up? We can't see you. Thanks.
Paul Holloway. Two questions. You mentioned behind the end of the first paragraph, we're talking about the doctor specializing in alcoholics and drug addiction. Do you feel like alcoholism and drug addiction, same disease, just a different name for it, or...
That's a great question that we're certainly not going to get into tonight. However, the one great answer is that back in 1939, they were acknowledging and speaking to drug addiction. To me, that's the only reason I read it and reread it. I don't know if I know for me, I can't drink and I can't use. All you have to do is see someone who's been sober a while, have to have an operation, go in the hospital, end up with the IVs and the OxyContin, and then they're down the road. They're either dead or in detox if they're lucky 5 years later. Alcoholics can't use, and drug addicts can't drink, so you be the guest. How did you make out in that area? I know that. I know that, baby. I know you long enough, Jim. All right, another question. That was a great question, by the way. Yes?
So, Rockwell, Jeff.
Jeff.
At the bottom of Roman numeral, I think it's 27, it says they believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. I think that capital P on the power, and I was wondering if you guys wanted to, because we seemed like we went right to the next page and didn't start talking about God until the next page, and I just noticed it the previous page.
Well, what could they possibly be talking about?
Well, that's what I'm saying, in the doctor's opinion.
Power with a capital P, you know? What could they, what could, I, you know, figure it out. You know? You got to be willfully blind.
All I can say to you, Jeff, is that it? For me, I was blessed. I didn't have, like, God come into my living room, not directly, but... My
like, you would recognize him?
Whoa. Yeah. My second day in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got clean February 12th, 1980. On February 14th, I wrote a letter that I have today, four-page letter to my parents. And I said, dear mom and dad, I'll just paraphrase it. I don't know what just happened. I'm not making any promises to you. But I don't know if I'm going to use again. I found these people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I sent that to them. I had 2 days sober. Something had happened. I wasn't even acknowledging that it was God or a power or anything. And my original power, my God, had skin on me. You people. That's where I get my reflection. Because every one of us, like he said, is all the same. Nobody goes through anything different here. I'll never forget this good friend of mine, Connie Coyne. I think she lives out in the West Coast now. And she used to do the steps at the 12-step house all the time when I was new. And she would say, and we get to the fourth step, she says, now let me tell you something. I know everybody's always afraid to talk about sex. And says, let me tell you something. You can only do it so many ways, with so many people, or with so many animals. And whatever you think you've done that no one else has done, let me tell you, someone else has done it, and probably with a lot more class. So the bottom line is, whatever it is you're holding on to or thinking you're unique, I promise you, you're not. We've all done it. That's how we get here. We're mental defectives. It just said it here. We're in full flight from reality. It just said it here. Another question.
There was a gentleman over there that had a question. Yes,
oh, a bunch of them. Yes.
Tony, alcoholic.
Tony.
It says we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. Can you explain that? Can I hear that in your words? How to explain altruistic?
Wow. Well, now, you don't want me explaining this. This would get really, this is going to get weird if I explain it.
So then I'll do it.
Because if I start explaining, if I start talking about God and talking about helping other people and being grateful, I'm going to start talking about biblical stuff. I'm going to start getting into scripture. And you guys don't want me to do that.
Right. So what we're going to do is we're going to thank you for sharing. That's the humility. He got it at 33 years. I have 34 years. I'm still looking for it. Anyway, the reality is spiritual is God. Altruistic is giving of yourself. That's what we spoke about. That's the 12th step of this program. We go out and find the other person. Altruistic is realizing I'm here to help, not to harm. I did my hurt. I hurt everybody I came in contact with before I got here. Now my job description is to trust God, to clean house, and to help others. That's what neither of us are getting paid to be up here. Except I promise you this, when I leave here, I'm going to feel a little more filled up with the grace and spirit of God than I was before I got here.
What are the benefits of reading the big book and actually looking at it is if you get to answer questions like this, perhaps in such a way so that it's conference approved, okay? So let me read you something from the big book about helping other people through altruism and the concept about the spiritual concept. This is Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. This is Bill Dotson, the guy in the bed. Has anybody ever seen the guy in the bed? The guy, the squinty guy in the bed who ended up being sober for many years. There were two guys. There was Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. This is the third guy. They 12-step with the Bible in front of them. I mean, it was just there. That's the way it was. This is what he said on page 191. It would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a relief, such a happiness, such a something I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't got. And I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch, and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her this, "Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people." This is what he said. "I thought, I think I have the answer." Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing, and he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, "The Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep telling people about it," has been a sort of golden text for the AA program for me. Bill was altruistic. He was altruistic. He went out going okay, day and night, and so did Bob Smith. And they were altruistic in the altruism that they had. The motivation they had arose out of one thing, that they were grateful to God, and they gave him credit for having done it, to pay back. So don't think that they're talking about two different things. You know, altruism and going out and trying to help other people is intrinsically linked to, in their stories, having to do with their, not to puff themselves up, not because they're good, because you know something, I don't know, I hear people say, I'm spiritual, I'm not spiritual. I can tell you, I'm so far from spiritual, I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, that is my nature. If your nature is being good, well, I'm happy for you. My nature is being bad and selfish and thinking about myself. Anything that I have going for myself right now that's selfless, it comes only from God. And that was the same thing Bill Wilson. He said God did it for him, and that's why he was altruistic. And so to me, they're talking about the same exact thing. But once again, they're talking about it in such a way so it sort of draws you in. It doesn't necessarily... See, Paul's getting nervous.
No, I'm not nervous at all. I want to share a story. We're running out of time.
No,
that's why I grabbed your leg. When was the last time I got nervous?
You know, that's the
problem. When my wife called me and said,
To me, it's the same deal.
Very simply, it's a great question. We're going to get to you first next week, okay? Because we don't want to get you. No, they're sitting in the same place. But here's the story that I was. You know, my first meeting was the first meeting in this town of Narcotics Anonymous. 12 steps borrowed from AA. So I was clean and sober a couple of weeks or a month, and I was flying up to New York. And actually, the guy that I'm telling this story about called me tonight. So we only had one piece of literature in Narcotics Anonymous. It was this little white pamphlet. And I had about 20 of them in my pocket on Braniff Airlines. Now, you can see I seem pretty whack now. Imagine what I was like 34 years ago. Try to conceive of that. I get on the plane, the plane takes off, I am walking up and down the aisles with my Narcotics Anonymous pamphlet looking for people under 50 that might need to hear this. This guy Brad was on that plane. He didn't get sober then, but he now has 28 or 29 years. Okay? And the bottom line is, just like it said, I wanted to shout from the rooftops, "I can't believe what happened here. It's not possible." I was obsessed day in, day out. hourly I needed to get something in my body to help kill myself. All of a sudden I come in here, it's removed. How could I not want to tell the world about it? And that's the bottom line. I still do.
Fantastic. That's all the time we have to watch.